Years ago, I picked up the book Forbidden Archaeology, Riveting, Could Not Put It Down. I had to talk with the co-author Michael Cremo. Man, what a story. And now a new one out called Human Devolution by Michael Cremo, a Vedic alternative to Darwin's theory. We're going to talk about both of his works in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Michael Cremo is a member of the History of Science Society, the World Archaeological Congress, the Philosophy of Science Association, the European Association of Archaeologists, and a Research Associate in History and Philosophy of Science. After receiving a scholarship to study international affairs at George Washington University, Michael began to study the ancient histories of India, known as the Vedas. In this way, he has broadened his academic knowledge with spirituality from Eastern tradition as well. And again, he is the co-author of the book Forbidden Archaeology with Richard Thompson, and this book called Human Devolution. It's just incredible work. Michael, always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Always great to be with you and your listeners, George.
We're going to talk about both your works, Forbidden Archaeology, of course, and Human Devolution. Both of them are related. It's just a carrying on of the story. But when you both came up with your theories that humankind, we're not hundreds of thousands of years old, but hundreds of millions of years old, how did you get to that?
Well, that was part of my journey of self-discovery that took me, from the place where I was in the United States in the late 1960s, out of the United States to other parts of the world, where I was looking for different ways of finding the truth and different realities. And my personal path led me towards India. So that's where I got a lot of the inspiration for the work that I'm now doing. I came in contact with one of the gurus from India, Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who was one of George Harrison's teachers.
Yes.
And I was very interested in his teachings. I began to apply them to my life. I took up a system of meditation and yoga, and adopted a vegetarian diet, and I found it made me feel a lot better. But beyond that, I became very interested in the ancient Sanskrit writings, particularly the Puranas, which are called the histories. And in these ancient histories, I found descriptions of human civilizations that have existed on Earth for tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of years. And Richard Thompson and I were discussing that, and we thought, well, if what these ancient writings say is true, then there should be some physical evidence to support it.
Right.
And, of course, these accounts of extreme human antiquity are something that we don't find just in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. Practically all the wisdom traditions of the ancient world spoke about this, whether we're talking about the Egyptian civilization or Chinese or even tribal peoples, Australian Aboriginals, Native American peoples, they all pretty much say the same thing, that humans have been around for a long, long time. So we thought, if what these ancient wisdom traditions are saying is true, there should be some physical evidence to back it up. Of course, you won't find any physical evidence like that mentioned in the modern textbooks of archaeology and anthropology. But what we decided to do was to look a little bit deeper, go beyond the textbooks, go to the original scientific reports, the primary scientific literature of the past 150 years in archaeology and anthropology, mm-hmm. written by not the writers of textbooks, but by the original scientists who actually dug into the ground and were looking for things. And what we found when we did that, we found there was a whole huge amount of evidence for extreme human antiquity, accounts of human skeletons, human artifacts, human footprints going back many, many millions of years.
And strange things you couldn't even explain, like those balls of...
Well, yes, that's one of the very most interesting cases. It, Well, one thing to keep in mind, however, is, you know, as you go further and further back in time, the amount of evidence starts to decrease, which is what you'd expect.
Of course.
Because as time goes on, because of different geological processes of erosion and things like that, just a lot of it gets destroyed. So as you go further and further back in time, you find less and less evidence, not because that evidence never existed, but because it just, by natural processes, tends to get destroyed. So one of the most interesting of those early cases, going back about 2 billion years, is these round metallic objects that have been found by miners in South Africa. They're made of hematite, which is a naturally occurring type of iron. It's considered even today to be a semi-precious stone. I mean, different people in Africa, tribal peoples, use it as a semi-precious stone to make jewelry. You can buy hematite jewelry in stores today. But these round objects were really very interesting. They're about 1 or 2 inches in diameter. And the really interesting feature of them is the parallel grooves that go around the center of each one of them. Now, there's some geologists that say, well, yeah, you could find these things. Round objects could occur naturally in the layers of the Earth. But I think what's really interesting is these parallel grooves that go around the center of each object. And then some have suggested, well, maybe those grooves were put on afterwards in modern times. You know, the objects themselves might be old, but the grooves were put on in modern times. But I went to South Africa, and I had a meeting with the chief mining engineer of the mine from where these objects come. They come from a mine at a place called Ottosdal in the Western Transvaal region, and he showed me a block of mineral with these objects solidly embedded in them, and you know, some of them were partially coming out of the stone, and you could see the grooves going around the exposed surface back into the solid rock. So it's not that these things were carved with these grooves recently. And a few years ago, we had some metallurgists look at them, an independent company of metallurgists, and they said they couldn't explain how they could have formed naturally in the layers of the Earth. So I think until somebody comes up with a very good natural explanation of how these things could have formed with the grooves, we've got to consider the possibility that these things were made by someone with human-like intelligence about 2 billion years ago.
Any idea, Michael, what they may be, what their purpose might be?
Well, they are a mystery. My personal feeling is I think they were some kind of game pieces. That's what I think they were.
Game pieces.
Other people have different ideas. Some people have suggested to me they might have been perhaps waste from nuclear reactors or something, and that they were compressed pellets. But they don't seem to be radioactive at all, so that doesn't seem to add up. And they're not made of any kind of uranium or plutonium type of material.
How big are they, Michael?
Okay. About 1 or 2 inches in diameter.
Okay.
They're not all exactly the same.
Could they have been pellets to be used in some kind of weaponry?
Someone has also suggested that to me, that the grooves could have been part of something like that. So that's another possibility. But to me, I've seen in different museums from Stone Age Europe objects sort of like that that are said to be game pieces. So that's the particular theory that I have. But I think it's how can you really know?
What a mystery it is. And when you talk about civilizations being hundreds of millions of years old, you're not talking about just primitive civilizations, are you?
No. And there are two kinds of sources of information about these ancient civilizations. One is the records that have been passed down through time that we have left today, like the records that Plato gave about Atlantis, or the ancient Sanskrit writings, which contain descriptions of these civilizations, describing that they had spaceships that could travel from planet to planet, and also not just from planet to planet, but from dimension to dimension. They also describe that they had technologies like electricity, that they had weapons resembling our modern nuclear weapons. As a matter of fact, when the first atomic bomb went off, one of the scientists who was involved, Robert Oppenheimer, mm-hmm. who was a student of Sanskrit literature, when he was present when the very first atomic bomb was tested here in the United States and New Mexico, he started quoting Sanskrit verses, you know, that describe
the same thing.
This sort of thing. So it's really pretty interesting. Now, what you can actually find in the layers of the Earth is another question. Because even things that we consider the kinds of things that we consider to be very high tech, they don't preserve very well in the layers of the Earth. There are battlefields in Europe where huge battles took place with tanks and all kinds of weapons. And today you can't find anything there because it's all turned to rust. So I think that's why in a lot of cases what we do find is stone implements and things of that sort in the very, very ancient layers rather than computers and things of that sort, because they tend not to preserve very well in the layers of the Earth. But we do find sometimes some gold objects, because gold doesn't oxidize. That's one of the reasons why we consider gold to be very valuable, because unlike other metals, it doesn't oxidize, and it's fairly rare as well.
Michael, if we had buildings, skyscrapers as we have today, 100 million years ago, and they basically were left untouched, maybe in a calamity some of them were knocked down, maybe others weren't. But if the buildings just sat there over that kind of time period, millions and millions of years, would they merely just disintegrate to dust?
Pretty much they would. I just last year saw a study where scientists were saying, these were scientists who were considering like the human effect on the environment. You know, because, you know, we have a huge effect on the environment. They said, well, what if humans just disappeared from the Earth today? And all our cities were there and everything like that, but all the human beings were gone so that we could do nothing more, then gradually what would happen? And their conclusion is within several hundred thousand years, the cities, you wouldn't recognize them anymore. Everything would. Either the metals would be oxidizing and rusting away, and the buildings would be collapsing. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. So within a few hundred thousand years, and you can just imagine, I mean, because we talk about, I mean, there's earthquakes that happen, there are floods, you know, when our flood control systems are not working anymore, the dams break.
Asteroid strikes.
Gradually it starts disintegrating. And it was kind of interesting because a few years ago I was participating in an internet discussion group. It was an archaeology discussion group, and there were professional archaeologists there. And they were discussing among themselves. I wasn't even participating in the discussion. They didn't even know I was there, really, because I was just lurking, you could say, just to see what they were saying. And one of them raised the same question you did. What if 100 million years ago there was an advanced civilization, kind of like the one we have today, mm-hmm. after 100 million years, what would be left? And they said, well, pretty much what all you might see would be some thin layers of multicolored gravel that you wouldn't even recognize unless you were specifically looking for it. And I think that's one problem today. Nobody's really looking for this stuff. So, say, what if you did have somebody who had a laptop computer 100 million years ago? Well, it's not going to look, after 100 million years, it's not going to look like you know, the computer that's sitting on your desk right now, it's going to look different. It might look like a piece of squashed gum on a sidewalk or something.
Yeah, it could be 1,000 feet underground. Maybe dirt and dust could have covered it up.
Well, that's right. And there are interesting cases. You know, like there are cases from Heavener, Oklahoma, that I report in Forbidden Archaeology, where you had miners go down, you know, a couple miles under the ground, and they were kind of blasting out what they call rooms, because they were mining coal. And they would, you know, explode some dynamite, and it clear out, you know, what they call a room. And then they go into that room and start clearing out the coal, and they said, you know, these particular miners said that at the end of this particular room, they found a wall, you know, made of 6-inch square blocks, shining blocks that were so reflective they could see the reflections in them. And they said they told this to the owners of the company.
Yeah.
They pulled them out and sent them to another mine and filled in that place.
Huh.
So yeah, you're right. These things could be very, very deeply buried in the earth at this point. And say if you did have the remains of a computer, like I said, it might just look like some gum squashed on a sidewalk. But maybe if you did some isotopic analysis, you'd find compounds of minerals, molecules that don't occur in nature. You know, and you could say, well, yeah, there must have been somebody that had some high technology then. To be able to make these compounds. But that kind of thing requires a new mindset. It requires like a new set of scientists, younger generation of scientists.
Sure, they have to look beyond this. I bet there are computer models that would depict, for example, I bet the metal would oxidize and disappear into dust maybe over 100 or 200,000 years, not even hundreds of millions.
Oh, yeah, yeah, over a few hundred thousand years. So I think that's why we find in these very ancient layers, what we tend to find is objects made of stone, because stone doesn't change that much. You know, like, you know, the metal will oxidize, stone isn't going to oxidize. So in many cases, in the very, very ancient layers of rock, I think we find either objects made of gold. There was the case of that was reported in the Morrisonville Times in the year 1892. It told of a woman who was putting a block of coal into her coal-burning stove, and she cracked open this big block of coal, and inside she found a gold chain 10 inches long. And
that's
so
great.
So you do find things of that sort. Or there was a case that was reported by an investigator from the Smithsonian Institution from the state of Illinois, where there was a well boring going on, and from 114 feet deep in this well boring, they came up with a copper object that appeared to be a coin with inscriptions and drawings of human-like figures on it. And the level that it came from was about between 200 and 400,000 years old. Or you have the case from Idaho, where a similar case where they were drilling a well for water, and from a level about 300 feet, you know, they came up with a small stone sculpture, perfect shape of a female form, and it came from a layer about 2 million years old, and it wasn't something that could have dropped in from the top, because they had a casing, you know, that went
yeah.
all the way down, you know, so it wasn't something that fell in, you know, from the top. This is the it's called the Nampa image from Nampa, you know, Idaho. So you've got a lot of these cases.
Michael, stay with us. We're going to come right back. Lots more to talk with you about. This is just fascinating. Hey, pick up the After Dark newsletter. You get 14 wonderful issues for the price of 12. Call 1-888-727-5505.
That's 1-888-727-5505, or simply go online at coasttocoastam.com. Michael, so many things to talk with you about here. Next hour, let's devote the entire hour to human devolution, if we can.
Okay.
Do you believe that these humans, these intelligent humans from hundreds of millions of years ago, were part of the planet, we originated here, or were visitors here? Or did they genetically alter us like we hear in so many different versions?
Well, I think all these things are possible. It's not that it's either one or the other, which is something that I've mentioned. Sometimes, if we look at these ancient Sanskrit writings, we find accounts of Earth humans, terrestrial humans, that have, for example, a terrestrial mother and a celestial father, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's not that we're just here ourselves. We may be reproductively interacting with other human-like intelligent beings from elsewhere in the universe or from even higher levels of the universe. So I think there's a lot going on. People tend to want a very simple picture of human history on this planet. Either they want some very simple creation account where, God just out of nothing creates a couple of human beings and then everything goes on like that just on this planet. Or they want some very simple evolution account where the chemicals kind of combine together and you get fish and then mammals and reptiles and human beings finally or whatever. And then some people want very simple extraterrestrial accounts where the ETs come and
alter us and fix us. Yeah.
But I think the real story is much more complicated than that, because I think you've got all these things going on. I think there is some overall guiding intelligence in the cosmos that's involved in our presence here. I think there is a kind of evolution that's gone on, but it's not the type that Darwin talked about, because I do believe there is reproduction with modification going on, which Darwin talked about, but he thought it started with the more simple things, with the tiny one-celled creatures, whereas from these ancient wisdom sources, we get the idea that it was the most sophisticated and intelligent beings who existed first, gods and goddesses existing at higher levels of the cosmos, and by their reproductive activities, they produced the simpler things. So it's like evolution turned upside down, which is what we learn from practically all the ancient wisdom sources and from many of the modern accounts of reports from aliens and things like that, that there is a reproductive process that's gone on, and it's something that happens not just on Earth, but we're connected with all types of other intelligent human-like beings that exist throughout the cosmos. The ancient Sanskrit writings speak of 400,000 human-like species that exist at different levels of the cosmos. And as I was mentioning a few minutes ago, sometimes there are reproductive activities going on where you have terrestrials reacting with the beings from higher levels, the celestial realms, and producing offspring. So I think there's a whole lot going on. It's a very complex web of activities that involves something of evolution, something of creation, something of ET.
In your opinion, how sophisticated might we have been hundreds of millions of years ago?
I think things go in cycles, where you have civilizations coming and going over vast periods of time, sometimes rising, sometimes falling. Sometimes there are huge catastrophes that occur. And I found this very interesting. For example, modern paleontology tells us that since the beginning of the history of life on Earth, there have been six major extinction events. the last one being the event that resulted in the extinction of the dinosaurs.
63 million years ago.
Yeah, somewhere. And then a couple hundred million years before that, there was another one. And a couple hundred million years before that, there was another one. And after each of these extinction events, they say the Earth has had to have been repopulated.
It's almost like the planet cleanses itself in a strange way.
Yeah, I think that happens. So what I found very interesting is that in the ancient Sanskrit writings, which speak of time going in cycles, they have a similar idea. They say that the current creation cycle, the cosmic creation cycle, started about 2 billion years ago, which would be the time that scientists say that life began on Earth, which I think is interesting. And then since that time, in this larger cycle, there are sub-cycles called Manvantar periods. And according to the ancient Sanskrit writings, we've gone through, we're in the seventh one now, which means we've gone through six of them. And the ancient Sanskrit writings say that at the end of each of these sub-cycles, there's a devastation after which the Earth has to be repopulated. So I think that's an interesting coincidence between what modern paleontology tells us and what these ancient Sanskrit writings say, that life began on Earth about 2 billion years ago, maybe a little bit longer, and that there have been six major devastations after which the Earth has had to been repopulated. Now, the difference is the ancient Sanskrit writings say human beings were present in each of the cycles, whereas, according to modern science, they say human beings came into existence only after the last devastation, the one that killed the dinosaurs. So that would be a difference. So I think what happens is that time goes in cycles. And in these cycles, human civilizations develop to a certain stage, and then come these catastrophes. This idea of cyclical time is something that the Greeks and Romans had. They had the idea of a cycle of ages where you start out with a stone age and you go to an iron age and then a silver age and then a gold age and then the cycle starts over and over again. And again, this is something we find in the ancient Sanskrit writings, the idea that there are cycles within cycles within cycles of time. And in the course of these cycles, human civilizations go through different stages. They're called yuga cycles. The smaller cycles, they're called yugas. There's a golden age followed by another age, and another age. Four of them, just like we have four seasons, like spring, mm-hmm. summer, fall, winter. So according to the ancient Sanskrit writings, in the first stage in this cycle, it's an age where everyone is living in harmony with nature. There are no cities or anything like that. People are just living very close to nature. They're very spiritual. The next age, you get villages and cities and political systems coming into being and conflicts starting to arise in human society. And you could say the spirituality decreases by 25%. Then you go to the third age, and you get huge wars and conflicts and things like that. And then finally you come to the age we're in now, the Kali Yuga, where it just gets very intense. It's called the age of quarrel and hypocrisy. And there are predictions about that were written thousands of years ago telling what would happen in this age, that people would be taxed excessively. They would be running away from the cities, going to the mountains. There'd be a lot of conflict. You'd only get justice if you had money. Really interesting prophecies that are being fulfilled today. And finally, it says that the Earth's environment is going to deteriorate. Things are going to become very hot. In other words, it talks about this global warming.
Yep.
Idea.
Sounds like we're in one of those again.
There's going to be this desertification, and that eventually the whole thing will just collapse, and then another golden age will start again, and then you just keep going and going and going through these cycles. So I think the human civilizations, I mean, what we consider to be very advanced today may not really be so advanced.
Do you think it's possible that hundreds of billions of years ago, we might have had 6.5 billion people on this planet like we have now? We may have had automobiles every place, using up oil, complaining that we're going to run out. Do you think that was happening then?
Yes, I do think it has happened in the past many, many different times. And what I think is that that's the end of a cycle. Not that's we kind of think we're making progress. I think it's the, you know, it's the opposite.
Right.
Because it means we're becoming more and more absorbed in trying to control and dominate and exploit matter, when really we're spiritual beings and we should be concentrating on the higher things. And I think we're seeing how the world's suffering from that lack of concentration on, you know, the higher, more subtle energies that are associated with the human organism. So a lot of what we call progress today means, I think, we're just digging ourselves deeper and deeper into a very problematic situation.
Do you think that we were once on the moon? Ancient civilizations went to the moon.
Yes. According to the ancient Sanskrit writings, actually all these planets are inhabited or have been inhabited. This idea that human life has been confined to the Earth planet is, it's really a very, very interesting idea. You know, a few years ago, I was on a lecture tour of Poland, and I was speaking in the city, at a university in the city where Copernicus studied and worked. Of course, Copernicus was the scientist who first proposed that we get away from a geocentric picture mm-hmm. of the cosmos and realize that, yeah, there's all kinds of other planets, and that the Earth isn't the center. You know, that there's all kinds of other possibilities. He's the one that proposed the heliocentric picture of the universe.
Right, and he was right.
And so as I was speaking at this university, I said, well, I think it's time that we get away from not just a geocentric picture of astronomy, but that we get away from a geocentric picture of biology and realize that here the human beings that we have on Earth are just part of a whole cosmic system of intelligent life. And the people just burst out into applause. You know, they thought, yeah, we've got to do that. So yes, I think in the past, humans have traveled to other planets. And I think one thing we have to keep in mind is that there are different ways of traveling. Today, we tend to think that the only way to travel is in a tin can, so to speak.
Sure.
Whereas in these ancient wisdom systems, they had, you could call, systems of yogic or mystic traveling, where they could transport themselves mm-hmm. in other ways, which, you know, if you look into shamanic traditions and things like that, shamanic journeys and things of that sort, you'll have some idea of what we're talking about. And even a lot of the people who report alien contacts or having been abducted will often say that they are transported telepathically, or, you know, not necessarily always in some kind of machine to some, you know, different locality. So I think in the past, yes, humans did visit, you know, these other planets. So there are descriptions of this in these ancient wisdom traditions. You know, I was just reading some of the accounts in the ancient Sanskrit writings in a book called the Bhagavad Purana, about how a person on this earth manifested mentally a ship, a mind ship, and that he and his wife went and visited all the planets in our universe.
Instantly.
Yeah, just by, because the speed of the mind is greater than the speed of light.
Exactly. It's immediate.
Yeah, it's immediate. So I think, yes, humans did visit the moon. They visited other planets. And we have been visited by, you know, these other human intelligences from other parts of the universe, other levels of the universe.
And I think we're still being visited, Michael.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a fact.
I wonder when our astronauts went to the moon, 69 and through the 70s, if they saw what so many of us have speculated that they might have seen, structures on the moon, artifacts, other spaceships left behind, buildings. What do you think?
I think that's possible. And I mean, you're saying it like that it's a rather extreme possibility in one sense, but, you know, in 2003, I spoke at the World Archaeological Congress meeting that was held in Washington, D.C. It's the world's largest international organization of archaeologists. And I was very surprised. This is a mainstream scientific organization. They had a whole section on extraterrestrial archaeology. And, you know, it's sort of interesting. The United Nations and different governments are already passing laws about what to do about objects that are discovered on other planets.
Yeah.
How to treat them, who will own them. Now, part of what they're talking about is stuff that we've sent out there. But these archaeologists are also saying, if we've sent stuff out there, maybe other people are sending, maybe other intelligent beings are also sending things either to Earth or to other planets right. in our solar system. So what's going to happen when archaeologists find those things? So there's already a United Nations Outer Space Treaty that is dealing with topics like this.
I got to tell you, Michael, Richard Hoagland has a picture of what looks like the head of a robot on the moon, and it was taken by astronauts. I don't think they spotted the head while they were taking this picture of the scene. But I got to tell you, we have looked at this. It is not some kind of photographic freak or a rock. It is like a head of a robot. It just looks like C-3PO that his head was blown off. And it is sitting there on the moon, and we've looked at it on close-ups. It is absolutely amazing. I mean, it is comparable to the things you have found on this planet when we talk about ancient civilizations.
Right. And so I wouldn't be surprised at all to see things like that. Of course, I've seen some of the things, the photographs on Mars. I thought the tubes on Mars are really fascinating.
Isn't it? Yeah, those glass-like things.
Tube-like structures. Those are. I find those even more fascinating than the face on Mars or the pyramids and things like that. And then there's been for 20 or 30 years discussion about different apparently architectural structures on the moon. You know, very tall objects that appeared to be not natural formations. So I think there is going to be a whole extraterrestrial, you know, archaeology, you know, going on. And even the professional archaeologists are talking about this, which is really, I find, very, very fascinating, because we tend to think that all of science is very conservative and opposed to these things. But what I'm finding is that there's a whole new generation of people entering the sciences, like archaeology and anthropology and others, that are actually open to these possibilities.
New thinkers. Very, very Michael, stay with us, because now the offshoot of Forbidden Archaeology, Human Devolution, is next on Coast to Coast AM.